Jordan Jack to campus to interact with us for a day. She's been through a couple of events. She met with grad students this morning, then was participated in a roundtable earlier today about science writing, and then concludes with this, and then we drag her to a department picnic as her reward for this. We're very sorry. We're paying you in hamburgers and hot dogs. Hey, Jim. So this is Jim, who helped arrange this. This grew out of a prospectus defense. Heather Steinman, who is in the dissertation phase, is writing partially about neurorhetorics, and when Jim sort of noticed that this strange word existed on this prospectus, asked, well, what is this? Who's doing this? Dr. Jack's name appeared because I'd been passing around the URL to one of her tutorials on how to do neurorhetoric, which I think is actually a fantastic tutorial on how to do a rhetorical analysis, if you haven't seen it. And so we got to talking and very quickly raised enough money to bring her here. And so we got money from the provost, two colleges, both departments, the Department of Psychology and Department of English. And psychology was generous enough to let us to bring Dr. Jack over as part of their colloquium series. And this is the first one this year, correct? So you'll have like five more?
Every week.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, okay. I mean, what a great idea. So Dr. Jordan Jack comes to us from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And she did her undergraduate in Canada. What was the institution that it's on your
York somewhere? University.
What is it?
York
University. So for fellow Canadians, we have proof of, yes, connection here in the great white north, soon to be white north. Did her master's and her PhD at Penn State University. That's how I was sort of aware of her. And she worked with both feminist scholars and rhetoric of science scholars, and is herself well published in both areas. She's written two books. The first, are they both out now, or the second one is coming out?
Okay, they're both out.
And the first book, which was they're both published by the University of Illinois Illinois Press. The first book, Science on the Home Front: The Rhetoric of Women Scientists in World War II, grew out of and extended her research during your dissertation phase, correct? And then the recent one, Autism and Gender: From Refrigerator Mothers to Computer Geeks, which is no longer forthcoming, it's out. Both of them, University of Illinois Press, build off of her research in neurorhetoric, but extend it in, I think, very interesting ways. But I'm going to let you talk about it instead of nattering on. So please welcome Dr. Jack.
Thank you for having me. Dr. Andy Mara, who helped to arrange my visit, and then the psychology department for bringing me here. I was especially gratified when I flew in and I noticed that my choice of PowerPoint presentation exactly matched the typography of what I saw. So that was very exciting. I also realized that I'm speaking to an interdisciplinary group, and for a psychology audience, I probably have too much paper and not enough slides. But that's a genre difference, I guess, in our two fields. So we tend to read, which is kind of ironic. As rhetoric people, we should be performing. So I'll try to do a little bit of both. My title today is Creative Brains, Rhetorical Approaches to Neuroscience. And I'll just say that when I use the term neurorhetoric, I've been arguing that people in my field of rhetoric should study the rhetoric of neuroscience, so how neuroscience persuades and how people make arguments in neuroscience, if we're interested in the rhetoric, the neuroscience of rhetoric. So if we want to know about how the brain works and how communication in the brain can better be understood, we can't just take neuroscience as though it's this thing that exists there and it's fact, and we can just read articles for their factual content. But we have to know that scientists are trying to persuade each other too when they're publishing articles. And we need to be able to bring the same critical lens that we bring to our own work to the study of how scientists write. So that's where my training lies, and that's the perspective I try to take in my own research. So as you all know, the brain has become a key site of medical and scientific intervention. It's on everyone's minds. President Obama has devoted funds to a brain mapping project that will lead, hopefully, to interventions for things like Alzheimer's and epilepsy and autism, to name a few. But beyond that, we're all expected to improve our brain health these days. People who are aging are especially required or encouraged to improve their brains through different kinds of training programs. But all of us are encouraged to do this. So you've probably heard of Lumosity, which is one of the brain training regimes that is heavily advertised, and we talked a little bit about that today. But beyond that, there's brain diets, there's brain drinks, there's exercise regimens, various kinds. And all of these are focused on improving things like our memory or our creativity. In short, the brain now falls under what Foucault would call technologies of the self. So it's not just our bodies anymore that we have to perfect, but it's also our brains. Among the many qualities that fall under this brain training regime is creativity, and this is the one that I'm going to talk about today. And in fact, as I was writing this talk, I came across a new app called Coffitivity. And what it does is it plays ambient coffee shop music. And supposedly there's scientific proof behind the idea that this will boost your creativity. And while this app did actually help me to finish my talk, I'd like to think a little bit more about what people mean when they say creativity as something that can be subject to brain training or brain improvement. So what do neuroscientists mean when they study creativity? And I'm going to talk today about three cases, one involving freestyle rappers, one involving dancers, and one involving creative writers. So my presentation is part of a larger book project in which I'm thinking about how rhetorical theory can overlap with or intersect with neuroscience. And some of the other topics that I'm exploring are things like pleasure, violence, politics, and sexuality. But in particular, my project responds to problems that have been laid out by neuroscientists themselves. So in the case of creativity in particular, neuroscientists have noted that current research findings are, to borrow Anna Abraham's words in a recent review, cluttered, inaccessible, and even contradictory, due to a tendency to see creativity using what she says is a wide range of tasks and even different behavioral measures within each task, ranging from verbal to music to artistic creativity to scientific creativity, and a corresponding tendency to describe results nonetheless under the rubric of creativity as a whole. Similarly, in a 2007 review, Arnie Dietrich lambasts creativity research in neuroscience for a tendency to consider it as a monolithic entity, where researchers focus on a particular facet of creativity but nonetheless describe the results in terms of the whole of creativity. So you'll notice a pattern here in how we're talking about it. And rhetoricians would call this pattern a synecdoche, so a part for the whole substitution is what's going on. But this state of affairs extends more broadly to other areas of social and cognitive neuroscience research to varying degrees. In a 2008 article in the Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience, Dina Weisberg and her collaborators identified three types of problematic claims. They pinned these particularly in popular accounts of neuroscience. So she identifies neurorealism, neuroessentialism, and neuropolicy as the three types of claims. And you'll see I've defined them here and given them kind of a rhetorical interpretation. So the first type is neurorealist claims, and these are claims that make a phenomenon concrete and locatable, and sometimes naively so. So something that is an abstract concept like creativity becomes a real thing that somehow exists in the brain. The second type of claim is neuroessentialism, and that reduces a complex concept to something that's measurable. So neurorealism and neuroessentialism can kind of often work together. So if we can make something like creativity a measurable thing, then we can also locate it within the brain. From a rhetorical level, I'd say that the first claim, neurorealism, corresponds to this idea of stasis. We have these stasis categories that rhetoricians use to understand an issue. So the first one is, does it exist? So does something exist in the brain would be the question that corresponds to realism. And then to answer that question, you have to reify that thing. You have to make it something concrete. And often how they do that is through a metaphor. So in popular neuroscience, you'll see things like, scientists have discovered the buy button in your brain. So that's a metaphor they're using to concretize the idea that there's like a part of the brain linked to consumer decision making or something like that. Or there's a God spot in your brain and that's supposed to link to religion. The second claim, neuroessentialism, answers the stasis question, what is it, and operates through reduction. And the rhetorical figure I see at work there is synecdoche. So that's where a part stands in for the whole. So if we want to talk about creativity, usually what happens is to operationalize it, you reduce it to something measurable, and then that stands in for the whole of creativity. So that's the problem that the researchers I cited earlier were finding with creativity research. And then the third claim is neuropolicy, and you see this when people will argue from a neuroscience finding, often prematurely, to some kind of end goal or something that we should do about it. So the one that comes to mind in my case, in North Carolina recently, they passed a law that students should be taught handwriting in schools again. And the reason they gave was that neuroscience research showed some kind of brain change when you taught handwriting. So the rhetorical operation I see there is extension, so it's often not necessarily it's an analogy, but it's often kind of a weak analogy. So here's a narrow scientific study. Let's expand that to some big political program so we should all learn handwriting again. So these are the three claims that I'm working with as kind of my tool set or part of my tool set for this project. And it occurred to me that as a rhetorician, I could kind of help to understand these claims, where they're coming from and how they're working, at least from my perspective. So the other thing that a rhetorical perspective adds here is that from a neuroscientist's perspective, these claims might be deemed biased. So these are just bad things, they're fallacies. But from a rhetorician's perspective, if these are key claims, types of claims that correspond to the stasis questions, they're not necessarily fallacies per se. And in fact, I would argue that they're actually kind of part of the requirements for doing neuroscience research, at least according to certain kinds of methods. So I'm looking especially at imaging methods in my own research. And so these things are in some ways embedded in the research protocols and experimental practices that people have to use to make claims. So to establish evidence, researchers first have to argue definitions into place. So what is creativity? How do we measure it? And often they have to do that by using variations of these kinds of fundamental claims. So my talk is drawn from a chapter in the book that focuses on the second claim, neuroessentialism. But part of the idea of stasis theory is that one follows from the other. So to get to the second stasis, you first have to answer the first one. So does it exist? You have to answer that before you can define something. So as I go through, they kind of these claims build on each other. So I'm going to focus especially on the first two today. The creativity research doesn't tend to be used to translate into policy claims as much, but I can see it working that way. So dance stimulates creativity, hence we should teach dance in schools or something like that would be the neuropolicy outcome. So I'm going to talk about three different examples, as I mentioned. So a dance example, freestyle rapping, and creative writing. And I'll show how neurorealism and neuroessentialism allow neuroscientists to define creativity in such a way that it can be measured using technologies like fMRI or EEG, usually by creating a contrasting set of conditions. So you have a creative condition, which is usually composing a dance or a rap or a written piece spontaneously, and then a non-creative condition, which is almost always copying a dance or a rap or a written piece. And I'll show how a rhetorical perspective can help us to enrich our understanding of what's really going on there when we contrast copying with a creative production. And specifically, these studies overlook the role of imitation, which is a rhetorical concept, and the concept of invention. So these are linked rhetorical concepts that describe how is it that you learn to become creative and to produce creative compositions. So the first example is the case of the modern dancers, and I've given the citation here. This study appeared in NeuroImage in 2009, and the authors begin by arguing that despite the importance of creativity, no conclusive definition of this mental ability construct has been achieved yet. So the implication is that this study can help to arrive at that conclusive definition. So even though the study does not actually end up doing this, it does position itself as contributing to that eventuality, I guess you could say. So the overall goal of the study is to pin down creativity, to make it something measurable and locatable in neural regions or circuits. So that's, to me, a kind of neurorealist and neuroessentialist goal. I'm not saying that in a disparaging way, but that's part of the goal, to understand what it is, to answer those two first questions. Does creativity exist? What is it? So in the study, the authors recruited two groups of participants, a group of trained professional dancers and a group of novice dancers who had only completed a basic class. So again, you can see the creative, not creative implication there. The professional dancers were mostly ballet dancers, They were all professionals or advanced students who trained 5 to 7 times a week, and they had started training in early childhood. The design of the experiment itself then categorizes its subjects a priori as creative and non-creative. So the dancers presumably were creative types, hence they served as the test group, and the non-dancers are the non-creative types. Yet the differences between the two groups go far beyond whether or not we can describe them as creative. So their brains are already different. The dancers have had years of training in a specific area of competence that is being invoked in the study, an area that happens to include training in the kinds of skills we label creative. So that's in itself a rhetorical act to say this is creative, doing dance. The non-dancers may have had training in other kinds of creative activities, so they might be artists or painters or musicians, who knows, but they did not have the specific background of the dancers. So thus, it is not creativity per se that distinguishes the two groups, but a particular set of experiences, habits, and learned skill, which include not only the ability to perform dance steps, but musicality, performance, expression, all of which are practiced during dance training. The setup of the experiment then constitutes creative and non-creative types through a form of neuroessentialism. The dancers are taken to stand in for creativity, so that's the synecdoche, assuming that there's some kind of creative essence in their abilities that the non-creative group presumably does not have. So the tasks given to the participants also reflect this synecdoche as a kind of line of reasoning. One task is chosen to stand in for creativity and the other for non-creativity. So the creative task given to participants was to imagine themselves performing a dance for 3 minutes, and they were instructed to mentally perform a dance which should be as unique, original, or creative as possible. And this is contrasted with the presumably non-creative task, in which participants were asked to mentally perform a basic waltz, a common standard dance, according to the authors, which involves a sequence of monotonous steps or movements. So the description of this task, even in the article you can see, is rhetorically constituting one thing as creative, original, novel, and the other as not. And so while there is certainly more ingenuity required in mentally creating a new dance, this is not to say that the waltz task does not involve some kind of creativity or imagination. And in fact, those who are trained dancers had undergone a pedagogical curriculum that includes practicing basic steps, including dance steps that go along with a waltz tempo. So in ballet, you do balances to waltz. So I'm imagining that's what the ballet people would be imagining, at least from my perspective. So in Europe, they use a particular curriculum, the Royal Academy of Dance curriculum, and it provides a standard curriculum of movements that you practice day in, day out for a year or so until you're tested on them, and then you move to the next level, and it's the same steps, only a little more complex. And that's how you learn ballet. Even professional dancers, they don't just show up and perform, but they go to class every morning. You take a bar class, and you do your pliés, and you are constantly honing and perfecting the same basic steps. And this is what primes the body for creativity. So in her book, The Creative Habit, Twyla Tharp, who's a famous choreographer, writes that this exercise and repetition is what generates creativity. Dancers, she says, are totally governed by ritual. And it starts every day with their morning ballet class, and that's the start to their creative day, she says. So performing these basic or memorized steps does not necessarily exclude creativity. For example, a student performing a memorized combination might be encouraged to practice phrasing, so that's shaping the pace and feel of movements to match the musical phrasing, or emphasis, which would be highlighting certain movements to go with the music, so you might lengthen the movement of an arm or like syncopate the movement of a leg or something like that, depending on what you wanted to stress. And then also performance, so you might practice performing the same basic walks, ballet classical walks, with a regal style or a kind of more soft lyrical feel, something like that. So even with something like the waltz, you can imagine the ballet dancers lending it these different kinds of nuances as they're imagining it in their head. And these are the same movements that choreographers draw upon time and again and just tweak in different directions. So thus, it seems like the study might be measuring something more specific than creativity per se, but maybe the neurological correlates of improvisation in particular. Since trained dancers, and for those of you who are the neuro people in the audience, you can have fun with this chart. But since the trained dancers presumably had more experience with improvising dances, it's not surprising that they might recruit different neurological processes than the non-dancers when imagining a new dance. They not only have a repertoire of bodily movements to draw on, But they also have practiced improvisation. So that's a common technique in a dance class or in a workshop. And in fact, the RID curriculum, I happen to use that curriculum because I'm from Canada and we do everything the Royal Academy way. But it involved improvisation. That was one of the things you had to do to pass your exam, is improvise to a piece of music. So they practiced that particular skill as well. So what they're drawing on is not simply creativity, but trained capacity, a learned capacity built on a foundation of memorized copy movements that become part of one's bodily repertoire. So in improvisation, you draw on these stock movements and patterns much the same way that a rhetorician draws on common topics. We call these topoi. So these are common places that you go to when you're improvising a speech. So as a rhetorician, I see a lot of parallels here between what a dancer might do when composing and what a rhetor might do, a trained rhetor. And the other thing that's similar would be genre knowledge. So we talked about that at the lunch today, about how you write in certain genres. So you also do that in dance. So depending on what the music is, if it's an allegro combination, a fast and lively combination, you do jumps and leaps. And if it's an adagio combination, you do slow arm movements and développés. And there's kind of a sense of what goes with what. In this study, participants were asked specifically to do something new and original. So what a lot of people did was they would violate the genre expectations. So instead of performing hip-hop dance to hip-hop music, they would imagine themselves doing ballet to hip-hop music or something. So they knew genre conventions, and then they were able to flout them mentally when they were imagining these compositions. All of these dance styles draw on a deep history, too. So there's a lot you could say about how dancers might be invoking a history of movement that they knew about. Twyla Tharp offers a really interesting case to think about what goes into the creativity of a dance improvisation or a dance choreography. So she talks about how, for her dances, she does things like bring a group of dancers to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and look at images of people. So she describes looking at ancient figures and having people try to emulate the sculptures with crossed arms from one wing of the museum, or the African wooden fertility sculptures for another composition that she made, or Egyptian figures who were in these isometric poses. So she would draw on all of those kind of references when she's composing a new dance. And then she also talks about her research process. So it's a lot like a writing process, and I love her book, The Creative Habit. So for each new dance that she composes, she gets a box, and she just starts throwing everything in the box. So she uses the example of Moving Out, which is a Broadway show that she did using Billy Joel's music. So in the box, she would throw all of Joel's music. She would listen to everything that he recorded, and then think about how she could draw from the characters in his songs and create a narrative using those characters. And then she studied the time period, so she decided to set it from 1965 to 1984. So then she referenced things like Soul Train and news footage from the Vietnam War and key books from the time period, other films, pictures of Joel himself from this time period. So all of this went into what eventually informs the choreography for Moving Out. And she calls this process scratching. So this is what she calls a process that looks like borrowing or appropriating from other sources, but it's an essential part of creativity for her. So scratching around in an archive of stuff is how you generate ideas. And in the same way that Shakespeare referenced the Chronicles of England and Scotland and Ireland when he was writing his plays, we all scratch around when we're trying to develop ideas. So that's another part of creativity that we don't see reflected when we just talk about copying a waltz as though it's a non-creative habit. So it might be the fact that if you were composing a dance that involved waltz, scratching around in what had been done, copying the waltz pattern repeatedly and figuring out how could I do this differently would be part of the creative process.
Do you know in that article that you would reference, did they depict that? Did they go off earlier studies that looked at creativity and different kinds of dance? So were they already using somebody else's model and then applying different methods to evaluating it with the EEG?
It seemed like it just came out of nowhere, from what I could tell, but I'd have to go back to the study to look at it.
That seems odd.
Yeah, but research, we scratch ourselves as researchers, right? Like, how have other people operationalized something? Let me try that out for this study.
That's not scratching, that's research. That's research.
Right, so it's exactly. So when you compose something, you're doing research. What we would call doing research is what Tharp calls scratching, digging around for new things, for old things that you can repurpose into new things. So my point is that by drawing on the perspective of someone trained in classical ballet or a scholar of dance, or I would say even a rhetorician, the researchers might have calibrated their study differently and what it purports to measure. So what is it that they were actually studying? So they might have studied that what they were studying was really improvisation, not creativity writ large. And they might have tailored the task to provide a bit more of a fine-grained analysis. So, for instance, the setup opposes improvisation with rote repetition of a dance step. But you might say, okay, in between those tasks, what about having dancers perform creatively perform a combination that they're given? So a set combination, but I want you to perform it creatively. You know, play with the musicality or the phrasing or the performance of it and see, how is that different? So can we have some intermediary steps between just copying and producing something new to show that they actually, to see how they overlap? Or they might have offered just a little more in way of discussion about the differences between those who had ballet training and those who did not in terms of the kinds of bodily and mental skills that they would have already brought to the study. So take the finding that dancers activated a wider range of brain areas in the improvisation than did the non-dancers. Does this mean that the dancers were more creative, or just that they drew upon resources developed through dance training, and were they just activating existing steps or movements or genres from their repertoire? So was it creativity per se that we see in the differences between these slides, or is it something else? So a dance scholar or a rhetorician might help neuroscientists to see that what they're trying to study under the rubric of creativity actually involves a complex set of processes, something akin to rhetorical invention, that is embedded in individual histories of dance training, which are in turn embedded in cultural histories and genres. So this would not entail rejecting neuroscientific approaches to creativity, but it would require a more flexible, specific definition of what it is that's being studied. And one might also develop more specific tasks that would help to operationalize these sub-processes involved in improvisation or other dance activities. So a similar